potted history of
potted
pride.
History of pride. Yeah.
A potted history of pride is the story of resistance. It's the story of a struggle to be seen, to be recognized, to be accepted, to be celebrated, to be able to say to the world, I am amazing, I am fabulous, let's all have a great riot of a party together. Pride started as a riot, and we acknowledge the fact that it came from Stonewall in the US, and it has changed over the years, but at the core of it, I think it is a fight to say we deserve equality.
That was Dan Vo from the Queer Britain Museum, which opened earlier this year. More from Dan later. 2022 marks 50 years since the very first Pride March in London, and now Pride lasts for the whole month of June, here in the UK anyway. Big brands stick rainbows on their products, from shoelaces to sandwiches, and politicians of all stripes struggle to remember all the letters in LGBTQIA+, which stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer or questioning, intersex and asexual. But what does Pride stand for now? How has it changed? And how has it changed the world? In this special archive hour, I'll ask these questions and introduce you to some queer pioneers. And I'll take you back to my first Pride in Edinburgh in 1995. Spoiler, it rained and I didn't pull, but it still changed my life. On the 2nd of July 1972, an oppressed group stood together and stood up for themselves. They were angry, they were afraid, they were excited, and they were outnumbered by police. But what they were not was ashamed. That day, they marched together as one and felt a new feeling. Pride. Just as publicly and powerfully as the suffragettes before and Black Lives Matter after, the very first Pride in London marks a turning point in civil rights history. And of course, that first Pride was very much in the spirit of and inspired by the Stonewall riots in New York City in 1969. The importance of the UK's first Pride march cannot be overstated. So-called homosexuality was illegal between men until 1967, and we'll be hearing a lot about laws in this programme. Now, of course, one programme can't represent an entire gloriously diverse and often fractious movement. I don't expect all straight people to agree on everything, so I don't see why all LGBTQ+ people should either. As we'll also hear, Pride itself is not without prejudice. And you'll hear some absences in our archive. That first march I went on wasn't covered, and Pride is often still ignored by the media. Up first, a quick bit of history. In 1553, King Henry VIII's Buggery Act brought in the death penalty for what it called acts of sodomy. In 1861, Queen Victoria's Offences Against the Person Act generously abolished the death penalty, but introduced a minimum 10-year sentence. The Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1885 made any male homosexual act illegal, whether or not a witness was present. This meant that even private acts could be prosecuted. And as is so often the case, women were left out of the law, but certainly not unpunished. Reform finally came in 1967. Centuries of hate enshrined in law were to be swept away, but with conditions, and it wasn't exactly done with love. Labour MP Leo Apsey sponsored the legislation, and here he is on the Today programme in 1967.
And we do not condone homosexuality. What the House of Commons has decided is that the homosexual has enough troubles without, in addition, having the fear and insecurity and the blackmail that arises from the existing law.
The Sexual Offences Act received royal assent on the 21st of July 1967, but this law only applied to England and Wales. All so-called homosexual acts remained a crime in Northern Ireland and Scotland and in all the armed services. The age of consent was set at 21 for sex between men, compared to 16 for sex between men and women. Lesbians were left out. So, now some of us were legal, in some places, in some circumstances. For many, that just wasn't enough, so they formed a radical new organisation demanding nothing less than total freedom, the Gay Liberation Front, or GLF. And it's with them that our march really begins.
Listen to me, sister, and hear me, brother, too. This song contains a message, and it might apply to you.
Among the GLF activists in those early years were Nettie Pollard and Ted Brown.
For me, as a young black American who during my teenage years had been watching the American Civil Rights Movement, led by Martin Luther King and people like Rosa Parks, being fought and clubbed and arrested by the police in America, when they were seeking equality in racial terms, I felt that my action as a black gay man was furthering a civil rights campaign that gay people, lesbians and gays, deserved at least equal rights with others, and that was part of the campaign for human rights.
I remember in 1971 that we all went on an anti-internment in Northern Ireland demonstration, and loads of people from GLF went on that one. And what made us different from the other marchers was we had things like the International Marxist Group and International Socialists and Irish groups, was our solidarity. We marched together, we held hands, we had our arms around one another, and the police could not pick us off. You know, I remember a police officer trying to arrest somebody, and we simply wouldn't allow it. And I mean, that was what GLF was like, because we had such togetherness, such solidarity. We were different from other radical groups.
Do you want sympathy?
No!
Do you want aversion therapy?
No!
Do you want psychiatric aid?
No!
Do you want...
One of the first Central London marches was organised by the GLF youth group, which was the protest against the unequal age of consent laws. Any gay sex had to take place in private. And when they said private, they really meant it. Apparently, if you lived in a block of flats and were having sex with your partner, you could be arrested because there were other people in the building, even though they weren't in your own flat. This was the first organized march through central London, but there had been a previous demonstration by GLF in Highbury and Islington against police arrests of gay men who were cruising. So by the time we had the Pride March in 1972, GLF had organized two major demonstrations.
We are everywhere! We are everywhere!
Another surviving member of the original GLF is the fabulous Stuart Feather, who was famously arrested, dragged up as Mary Whitehouse. I met him at the opening of Queer Circle, a new LGBTQ plus cultural space in South London. Tell me about the march in 1972. Was it even called Pride? What did you call it?
It was called Gay Pride. Yes, that was the inspiration of Tony Reynolds, who was only 19, who a year before gay liberation came about in this country, he was arrested in Notting Hill for defacing public property by chalking gay rights demands on the pavement and on buildings. What did I expect? Well, really, for it to be like the Age of Consent March, which it very much was, with lots of people jeering, others applauding.
So when you say people jeering, do you mean people on the street jeering at you?
Yes. I mean, that's what we met on the street, yes. Some people jeering, some whistling, of course, lots of whistling going on. Some sort of hand flapping, you know, and we were going past saying, not like that, like that.
Did it feel dangerous?
No, it didn't really feel dangerous at all, no. We had utter confidence, 200% confidence that we were right and they could do what they want, but it wasn't going to change our minds at all.
How were the police on the march?
Oh, there were so many of them that you could hardly see us. you know, and they all looked down their noses in total disdain, except Andrew Lumsden says a copper gave him a very sly but sexy wink. So, you know, that was the thing with GLF and the police, is that if we could make the police laugh, not all of them, but we could make them laugh, and we wrong-footed them all the time because they were trained to deal with lefties who wanted to go on a march just to have a go at them. Mm. And if you could make them laugh, it meant we'd split the ranks and actually we'd won.
That's brilliant.
Well, I remember getting up that morning and going down to, from Kilbrook Road, where I was living, to Blackheath Station to catch the train. I was clutching my Gay Liberation Front badge, feeling very mixed about wearing it. I felt quite brave, but also a bit confused, because I knew that anybody else seeing it on the train didn't know what gay meant.
And I got on the train with my girlfriend, and we both had GLF badges on, and we made sure that we held hands when we were on the train on the way there, because by then we were all feeling much more assertive. Things had changed. I mean, it was, you know, it was actually only just over a year since I got involved in GLF, but it had a profound effect on me.
Well, I remember getting to Trafalgar Square and walking around, not being sure exactly what I expected. There were a small number of people at each corner of the Trafalgar Square, but it wasn't until I saw somebody carrying one of the banners saying, "I'm okay, I'm gay," and I wandered over to them and stood around with them chatting and having quite a good time.
We were also supported by the Campaign for Homosexual Equality, and so that was very good. And there was also Oxford Gay Action and a few other little groups that came in solidarity, and because the whole idea was catching on then, this whole idea that you shouldn't be ashamed and that it was society that was sick, not us.
Well, several hundred people marching down the streets carrying banners.
Oh, banners, yeah.
Everything that the march did was supported and carried out by the people involved. We financed it ourselves. We fought for it for ourselves. And I think that gave us real strength.
Really, we were just us and the banners. And
yes.
We went to Hyde Park and did some amazing things, like have a kiss in, which Ted in particular was involved in, weren't you?
Yes, yes.
We knew what would happen, and it happened. All that mass of policemen suddenly vanished as soon as they saw us kissing each other. They couldn't stand it, so they went and left us alone in the park to have a party.
Lovely. Were there any kind of floats? Was there music?
There was definitely music. Yes, Ginger Johnson and his band led off the 71 march and the 72 march. Floats, no.
That sounds like all the fun. In 1980, the BBC finally reported on London's gay pride as part of a documentary called Coming Out, and it marked a noticeable change in attitudes as homosexuals become gays. Now, this man sounds as if he's reporting a major maritime disaster, but at least he's talking about us.
This event is billed as the climax of Gay Pride Week. But in effect, it's the climax of 10 years in which homosexuals have acquired a new pride and a new name. Today they're called gays, and they're coming out on the streets of London. They assembled off the embankment at 1 o'clock on a June day in the summer of 79. Nearly 1,500 policemen were on duty. A symbolic presence, for this march commemorated a famous brush with the law. 10 years previously in America, homosexuals who frequented the Stonewall Inn in New York's Greenwich Village grew exasperated at continuous police harassment and hit back. The riot that ensued was the flashpoint of the gay liberation movement.
This is the head of the procession here.
Throughout the 1970s, government surveys found around 70% of the population found homosexual relations between two adults always wrong. I'm not sure I could have survived in such a hostile climate, never mind go on telly and show my face and talk about it. As a boy in the 1980s, I was routinely bullied for being gay, so, like many before and since, I hid away in books and libraries. In 1979, Gay's the Word bookshop opened in Bloomsbury in London. As a gay writer, it occupies a very special place in my heart. The bookshop also has a very special place in the history of Pride because of their links with Lesbians and Gays Support the Minors, which is celebrated in the 2014 film Pride. Here's the lovely Jimmy McSweeney, part of the Workers' Cooperative, running this iconic bookshop. So, Jimmy, what role did Gay's the Word play in the early Prides?
Gay's the Word at the start was a part bookshop, part cafe meeting space. So in the evening, activists would come together and talk about how they might plan a pride. It wasn't organised by the shop itself because the shop was already really busy just working out how to run a lesbian, gay, feminist bookshop. And it was, you know, a few staff and some volunteers. But anything was possible. You were out to change the world. And that's what you were doing.
So, Lesbians and Gays supported the Miners, and in turn, the Miners marched at Pride in 1985. Friendships were forged that day, and a shared movement was born. At the Labour Party conference in Bournemouth later that year, a resolution committing Labour to the support of LGBT rights was passed. And this happened thanks largely to a single block vote from the National Union of Mine Workers.
I think all lesbians and gay men who are attacked by the police, attacked by the media, attacked by the state, know what it's like to be attacked. That's why we're here openly as lesbians and gays and as socialists to support the miners. A victory for the miners is a victory for us all.
My very first Pride was in 1984, and it was extraordinary for me. It was part of a week called It's Not Just a Phase Week. There seemed to be lots of policemen on either side of the march. It was very much a march. That idea of walking hand in hand, holding your hands of your friends or your lover, was just so empowering. And to look around and see people just like me, or seeing people, you know, in leather or clones or fabulous drag queens or, you know, lesbian mums, just the whole range of the community and how ordinary we were. And it was kind of in the back streets of London. And we ended up at ULU, University of London Union, and had a wonderful party. It was fun. And there were lots of, you know, chants and 2468, is that policeman really straight, as they looked very glum looking on. And it was empowering. And of course, in the press, there was absolutely no coverage. You know, it's just a march that was happening. Oh, none whatsoever.
Did you feel safe when you were marching? And what were the reactions of people around you on the street when you were marching?
When we'd be marching, there would be people looking bewildered, but in the main, people had smiles. But we also didn't care. There were so many of us, we were just enjoying ourselves, dressed in your Sunday best, looking good, you know, looking around. You would see a group and then you march under them, and then you go, hang on, this is SM Gays, is this me? Or this is the gay Christian group, and you say, hang on, and you'd move back or forward, depending on which group you wanted to be with, and seeing friends and laughing and talking. But it's like carnival. It's so, I mean, this is so many years ago, but your very first Pride and your early Prides, it's so empowering, because for once, you were not in a minority, and for once you're not being gawked at or even modifying your behaviour. You can absolutely, on this day, be completely yourself.
Jimmy loved Pride, and Pride was helping to shift public opinion. But it wasn't happening overnight.
Well, to be quite frank with you, I think the laws of the land are wrong, myself, in allowing this sort of thing. I think it shouldn't be allowed on the streets. That's my own personal opinion, being a Christian, a practicing Christian.
They're right here behind
you. I think it's disgusting, to be quite frank with you. I think man ought to go with a woman and woman ought to go with a man. Illegally married, the lot, you know, this is how it should be. I don't believe in this sort of thing. I think it's wrong. It's an abomination.
Hello, London Gay Switchboard. Can I help you?
Yes, of course I'm bent. That's why I'm here.
No, L-O-N-G-A.
You don't like bent people. How unfortunate for you. You must lose out an awful lot. Why did you bother to sign us off if you don't like bent people?
The volunteers at London Gay Switchboard, which opened in 1974, were on the front line of abuse every time they picked up the phone. And as rumours of a mysterious new disease began spreading, their support became life-saving.
The past weekend should have been a time of outright celebration for Britain's homosexual community, as a march through London ended Gay Pride Week, 7 days in which they commemorated the start of the gay liberation movement. However, the festivities were overshadowed by fear, fear of a mysterious new disease that has hit the homosexual community in America and has now come here.
Lisa Power was one of the volunteers taking calls in those very early, very dark days. She went on to co-found the British charity Stonewall in 1989 and was policy director of the Terence Higgins Trust.
In the 80s, there weren't a lot of prides in the UK. There were a small number. And indeed, in Cardiff, the first one was something like 1985. We were much slower to get off the ground than in London and Brighton and Manchester and Birmingham. There was a growing gay and later called lesbian and gay community in the 80s. We were getting organised. There was all sorts of stuff going on. And so there was a flowering of prides, but a lot of them died away again after HIV became a really big deal.
There is now a danger that has become a threat to us all. It is a deadly disease and there is no known cure. The virus can be passed during sexual intercourse with an infected person.
I remember that advert. I was 11 years old and terrified. I've got a birthmark on my neck and I became convinced that it was some kind of lesion. And I was sure that I was going to catch AIDS and die before I even got to high school. The papers were full of AIDS and gays and hatred and fear. I couldn't talk to my mum or my dad, but maybe I could ask a teacher for help. Maybe. The law had other ideas. And a warning, this clip contains scenes of Margaret Thatcher, which some listeners may find disturbing.
Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay. All of those children are being cheated of a sound start in life. Yes, cheated.
Of course, it's homophobia that's the learned behaviour, not homosexuality. Section 28 sparked protests across the UK and millions joined the march, including many new straight allies enraged by the cruelty of this law. Prides became even more political and angry. Ian McKellen, not yet a sir, came out in a radio interview in 1988, partly because of his rage about Section 28.
During the debate on Section 28 of the Local Government Act, which inhibited local governments from, quote, promoting homosexuality, a senior whip, Tory whip, in the House of Commons told me that this was a bit of red meat thrown to the right-wing wolves. It is impossible, of course, to promote sexuality of any sort, and so that law was nonsense, and it shamefully remains on the statute books. What that law, in fact, did was to promote homophobia, to encourage people to continue to be frightened of homosexuality, and see it as something so outrageously different from the norm that it should be banned by law. Fueled personally by an anger that it had such an effect, a bad effect on my own life, and I want to help young people come to terms with their own sexuality, so that they can lead fulfilled lives as individuals and feel themselves to be a part of society. At the moment, society insists because of this law that they should be marginalised and made a criminal for making love. It doesn't seem to me to be right.
Now, Scotland was slow when it came to decriminalising homosexuality. That didn't happen until 1984. But it was the first home nation to scrap Section 28.
Scotland is leading the way in scrapping a law that bans schools and councils from promoting homosexuality. The controversial law, known as Section 28, was passed by the Conservative government over 10 years ago. Scotland's First Minister, Donald Dewar, said he suspected that England and Wales would be following Scotland's example.
Rage about Section 28 dominated the Pride marches of the late 1980s and early 90s, but it wasn't the only battle being fought. In Scotland, Wales, England and Northern Ireland, the age of consent for men having sex with men remained 21. If you were straight, it was 16. In 1993, the Campaign for Equality reached its height at that year's Pride. The BBC programme On the Record sent one of their young reporters to cover the event, a certain Michael Gove.
Out loud and proud, thousands of homosexuals were in London yesterday, celebrating the love that until recently dared not show its face. Gay men and lesbians gathered for their annual Pride March, revelling in their sexuality. Gay men aren't equal in the eyes of the law. Their age of consent's 21, not 16. Some think that leads to secrecy, making violence against gays more difficult to prevent. Attitudes are changing, and many favour a relaxed approach to laws, which make criminals of young lovers. But it's difficult to tell if greater openness will lead the government to embrace reform and change the lives of those who've grown up gay in the 90s. Many of the men on this march will have broken the law repeatedly and persistently by falling in love as teenagers. Last year, hopes were raised that the age of consent for homosexuality and heterosexuality would be equalised. But many now fear the government won't make a move. So, what are the chances of a change in the law that makes young gay love a sex crime?
When a policeman came to my school to talk about drugs, I genuinely thought he could tell what I'd been up to with my best pal and that we would both be arrested in front of our year and sent to jail. I felt shame, I felt fear, I felt about as far from pride as you can get.
Tens of thousands of people marched in London today to demonstrate for the rights of homosexuals. It was one of several marches in Western capitals to mark 25 years of campaigning for gay rights.
In 1994, things started to change. Slogans from Pride could now be heard in Parliament. Edwina Curry, a member of the Tory Campaign for Homosexual Equality, tabled an amendment to the Criminal Justice and Public Order Bill to lower the age of consent from 21 to 16.
There are people in this country also who dislike, who even abhor homosexuality. Yeah. They are entitled to campaign for those opinions. Such views are held with passionate sincerity, of course they are. What such people are not entitled to do is to insist that their prejudices be written into British law.
Not all MPs were as supportive as Curry, or seemingly as sober. Here's Conservative MP Nicholas Fairbairn.
I do hope the House is not going to be misled by the fact that heterosexual activity is normal, yeah, and homosexual activity, putting your penis into another man's arsehole, is a perversion.
Order, order, order. We can well do without talk like that.
In the event, Curry's amendment was defeated by 307 votes to 280. And some of the MPs who voted against that change are still in Parliament. And I wonder how they'd vote now. In June 1995, Pride erupted onto the airwaves with a pioneering new BBC show called Gaytime TV. It was, of course, a late-night show with groovy synthesisers, and it was relegated to BBC Two, and it was hosted by Rona Cameron and Bert Tyler Moore.
Hello and welcome to Gaytime TV, the first ever lesbian and gay series on the BBC.
That's right. For the next 6 weeks, we'll be here queering your pitch with a brand new magazine show.
And one of the first things they did was cover Pride.
26-year-old psychology student Shirley Simpson has just come out and enjoys the scene in Glasgow.
I've never been to Pride before, first time, so a little nervous, but it's a nice sort of nervousness.
Dallas is 23 years old. He's never been to London, let alone Pride. His boyfriend Barry can't go. He's working.
I'm really excited. I don't really know what to expect because everybody's told me so much about it and how I'll probably get off the bus and just cry.
Dallas and his friends have decided to get dragged up for the trip to raise money for the Glasgow Men's Health Project where he works. They've dubbed their bus Priscilla, Queen of the M1.
Up, up, up. Hi, man.
I learned how to get along with Sawyer Bass.
I've never dragged up before. This is my first time, especially for Pride. But as soon as those tights went on my backside, I tell you, there was no going back.
Right, I'm going to do this again. This is the first of many. This is so fab. I love it. Pride!
Now, I was a student by then and far too busy going out to stay in and watch telly, but that same month I finally went to my first Pride, which also happened to be Scotland's first Pride, and it was called Pride Scotia. I went down there to the Blue Moon Cafe in Edinburgh, which is where we'd been told to assemble. I had no idea how many people would be there. It was before mobile phones, so I didn't even know if I could find my friends. I could hear drums. I could smell something that I would now identify as paupers. And there were loads of men in kilts, which wasn't that unusual in Edinburgh, only these kilts were made of leather and rubber. And there were more lesbians than I knew existed in the entire universe. And there were people kissing and holding hands in public in Edinburgh, which to me just seemed nothing short of revolutionary. I kept expecting the police, and there were lots of police, to come and arrest us, but it didn't happen. We were to march all the way through Edinburgh to the Meadows, which is the bit where everybody has their kind of picnics in the summer. And we were going to have drinks there and dance and, you know, maybe find our actual friends instead of wandering around lost. I remember big handmade banners shouting about AIDS, which had hit Edinburgh very hard. I don't remember what I wore that day, but I do remember that I felt I had to have at least one red ribbon on. I think I probably had two red ribbons on. And we were marching for the people that we had lost. We were marching with ghosts. There were lots of pink triangles. I was just discovering that part of my history. I'd known about the Jews and the Roma being rounded up by the Nazis, but I didn't know that they'd rounded up LGBTQ plus people as well. So I was learning my own history on that march, even as that march was a part of history. At that time, I was a student at Napier University in Edinburgh. I was studying journalism, the first in my family to go to university. And I did think, oh, maybe I should interview people. Maybe I should, you know, talk to them about this. But I thought, who would run this story? Who's going to care about gay pride? So there's a silence in that archive about my pride in 1995. There's also silence from the first Northern Ireland Pride, which was held in 1991. But in 1996, Pride Scotia did make it to the BBC's Reporting Scotland. And again, not everybody was happy.
It was a case of everyone welcome and anything goes. An estimated 6,000 people from all over Britain and the world came to Scotland to show their support for gay rights. And more importantly, it seemed, to have a good time.
We are here and we are queer. And we are a part of society. And we demand our right to be a part of society.
But although the atmosphere inside the cordoned off area of Glasgow Green was celebratory and friendly, it was definitely not contagious.
I don't think it's right. Like, we've got children here and they're frolicking about on the grass and that, so that's why we're walking around the outside of the park.
There was a serious side to today's fun. A petition was launched seeking a reform of the Criminal Justice and Sexual Offences Acts, calling for more freedom and equal rights for gays and lesbians in Britain. Today, though, no one was holding back.
It didn't rain all the time, and I didn't pull, or at least I didn't pull that I remembered. If I did pull, it wasn't very memorable. But that day did change my life. It was the first time that I felt like I was not alone. There were other people like me that I had a past and a present and a future.
I am what I am. I am my own special creation.
Pride has always been a protest and a party.
Or the ovation, it's my world that I want to have a little pride in.
And it's been the focus of my community's greatest battles. Full decriminalisation of same-sex relationships, an equal age of consent, healthcare for people with HIV/AIDS and PrEP to stop the pandemic, overturning the pointless and cruel Section 28, fighting for the right to marry, to adopt, to live and work freely and safely and joyfully.
I am what I am.
Nancy Kelly is the current chief executive of Stonewall, the organisation that's campaigned for LGBT plus equality since McKellen, Power and others helped set it up in 1989. Stonewall has been part of some of the greatest victories of the movement for equality, from doing away with Section 28 to civil partnerships, marriage equality, adoption and protections at home, work and school.
I have got such a soft spot for the tiny prides. Like, I love all the Highlands and Islands prides and stuff. Like, every year I end up crying, you know, I get really sentimental about it. You see these amazing celebratory pictures of these like really small community prides, like geographic community prides. And you see kind of LGBTQ plus people just being visible and like handing out rainbow pens. And there's like 30 or 50 people and they are just taking up space and celebrating who they are. And I find that really moving, not least because there's an intimacy to that, right? If I march through the streets of London, the likelihood of people seeing me is that know me is like nil, right? I mean, maybe not in this job, but every other time I've done it, you know. If you live in a small community and you are standing on the high street wrapped in a rainbow flag, everybody you know is going to see you. So there's a real kind of bravery and beauty in those smaller prides that I am always so moved by.
There's no doubt that pride helps to turn the tide against hate in the wider world, but the movement itself does not always represent or support everyone within it. Being gay doesn't stop you being homophobic, racist, or transphobic. We are not perfect, we never have been, and we never will be. The fact is, none of us are free until all of us are free. And this is part of the reason why different parts of our community are doing what the GLF did in 1972 and starting their own prides.
There's food, there's music, and there are plenty of rainbows. This is UK Black Pride.
Events like Black Pride show you you can be you, unequivocally, unashamedly, and I'm here for that.
People of colour have always been a part of the LGBTQ plus story, but the very first standalone UK Black Pride was in 2005. I had the joy of sitting down and chatting with the indomitable Lady Phil, co-founder and CEO of UK Black Pride.
When we talk about wanting to create spaces for ourselves so we can be visible, so we can be brave, so it can feel safe for us, these group of leaders, they laughed, they jeered, and one of them told me to, please excuse my language, to F off and go back to where I came from. We still sound shocked and surprised by this.
No, I'm not. That's the thing. I'm depressed. I'm just, it's like, it's kind of bleak.
Yeah, but I think the understanding of what I'm trying to say to you is just because we are from marginalised or underrepresented communities, it doesn't make people exempt from being bigots, right? It doesn't stop you from, you know, wanting equality and equity for LGBT plus people, but not necessarily wanting it for Black and POC LGBT plus people. We had, in 2005, the most amazing pride ever with over 200 people. It cost us £477.27. And that was 2005, where you can fast forward to 2019, our very last in-person event, although we will be having it this year, where we had over 11,000 people. We make sure that we are completely inclusive in the work that we do at UK Black Pride. And that takes many different forms. And I guess, you know, that advocacy, that grassroots community-led spirit of UK Black Pride is what makes us rich in what we take forward, how we take it forward, and how we are inclusive, not exclusionary, inclusive of our many different communities.
Do you have a march?
No. You see, we protest every single day. Our life's about protesting. So, you know, we don't necessarily have a march, and maybe that will come. But I guess it's for the community to tell us what they want.
UK Black Pride, how you feeling?
Welcome to UK Black Pride.
UK Black Pride means by us and it's for us. And it's exactly what you can see today.
Absolutely insane.
There are people who see new prides like Black Pride, like Trans Pride, like Asexual Pride, and think there's a problem here, or why do we need these spaces? And I'd like you to talk about that, because I feel like we do need these spaces. I feel like we all need these spaces.
Black Pride is not new. We have always had pride in our blackness. What's happened is you may not have seen it because there's spaces that have not been carved out for us. So when they're not carved out for us, we do it ourselves. And that's why we have a Black Pride, not to justify our existence, not to explain why we need something, but just to be able to live, to survive and thrive.
Another new pride started down the road from me in Brighton.
Trans rights are human rights!
Trans rights are human rights!
One more time with feeling. Trans rights are human rights!
Trans rights are human rights!
Trans Pride is the biggest event of its type in the UK and probably the world. I went to the newly opened Trans Pride Centre, whose walls are covered with incredible placards and banners, to meet Chief Executive Sarah Savage.
Happy Pride! We are the gift. We are valid. We are beautiful. There is nothing wrong with us. Quite the opposite. Everything is right with us.
2013, we all came together and we were really annoyed that some trans people had been to Brighton Pride and had faced discrimination. And it felt like a lot of people had said
that... In what
that,
way had they faced discrimination?
So, you know, they were visible trans people. And so because Brighton Pride is so large, it attracts a lot of people who aren't gay. And so a lot of those people come and they see a trans person and they're drunk and they shout stuff at them and they abuse them in the street, you know?
We are trying to help you. We have come here for your salvation, not for your destruction.
So we really wanted a space where we could put the T first in LGBT. And we really wanted to have an event where people felt like they weren't alone, because going to a large pride event, you can feel quite alone, you know? And so, yeah, it exploded from there. We had 800 people at our first event, and now we planned for about 10,000.
You were marching in that first march for trans rights. What is it that you're asking for?
Equality.
Yeah.
You know, at the moment, trans people are discriminated against when they go for healthcare. There's so many people who are fired or not even hired because they're visibly trans. The current media landscape is also very, very hostile to trans people. There are people who really, really have an ideological problem with the existence of trans people. And it's created a media environment and an academic environment of oppression against trans and non-binary people. And it's really ramped up over the last 5 years. You know, it's, yeah, it's awful.
I want to ask you now about your first experiences of Pride. When did you first go to a Pride march?
My first proper Pride march was London Pride, London World Pride 2012, I believe it was. And again, this is, you know, not very long after I first transitioned. I still hadn't found my confidence. And I got invited by Stonewall Housing, a London charity, to march with them. It was just so empowering to be there with a group of friends within, you know, 100,000 other people. And you know, someone gave me a megaphone. And that moment is where I found my voice. And I remember we went past Downing Street and gay marriage or equal marriage still wasn't legal back then. And I remember shouting through the microphone at Downing Street. And that moment really changed everything for me.
How does it change for you?
Like, I found my voice, you know? It sounds really cheesy, but, like, I found my confidence. It was the most empowering thing I've ever experienced. You know, I've been invited to many different prides around the country, and the vibe at that London Pride with hundreds of thousands of people is exactly the same as the vibe when I went to Hereford Pride. And Hereford Pride was less than 10 people in a room in a pub.
So important. important this year that we are taking up space, that we are filling the streets, that we are here in all our bright, beautiful, diverse, different, the same colorful realness. We are giving it so much and we all look so beautiful.
Trans pride is needed because only trans people know how trans people feel. And the same with why UK Black Pride is needed, because only black people know what it's like to live in this world with the discrimination they face. Primarily and first of all, trans pride is a protest. We say every year at the start of the protest march that this is a protest, and we have people talking about discrimination, and we have people talking about how they can build a better future. And because we start from a protest, it permeates the whole of the event. So while there is a party atmosphere in the park and we're all about positivity and encouragement and empowerment, people still bring their signs. People bring their feelings, and that permeates everything. So when you have look at our stage acts, they're all trans people and they're all shouting about the issues that matter to them the most. Trans Pride has always been organised by volunteers. We've always said no to sponsorship or donations from companies that don't have a brilliant record of supporting the trans community. And this has gone on to create what Trans Pride is today. We're very non-corporate. We're still led by volunteers. And we do not sell out. We're still a free-to-attend event. And I think this is what is really key to Trans Pride's success is we replicate the same kind of atmosphere that a lot of people have told us that Pride was 30 or 40 years ago.
I-T-Y. What's the spell?
Equality!
What's the spell?
Equality!
What's
the
spell?
So it's 2010 and the fight is on for same-sex marriage. We've got civil partnerships, but we want equal marriage. And why shouldn't we? Here is Peter Tatchell talking about the extraordinary moment where Boris Johnson was put on the spot by Ben Cohen of Pink News.
One of the game changers was Boris Johnson. We were all surprised that Boris turned up to lead the 2010 London Pride Parade. I saw this as a great opportunity to put him on the spot. So I scampered through the legs of the press scrum surrounding him, popped up in front of Boris, holding a sign, Dave and Sam Cameron can marry, gays can't. And they'd said to him, look, Boris, you're a libertarian. Will you support same-sex marriage? And he ummed and ahed and fluffed a bit, but eventually he said yes.
You said you were calling for gay marriage, are you?
I think if the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats could get together in a national coalition and settle their differences, then I don't see why you can't have gay marriage.
I can't remember the order, but I was there. I think a little bit tipsy from already having some drinks from Pride, but that clip was from my BlackBerry, I remember.
At that year's Conservative Party conference, David Cameron finally came out in support of equal marriage.
Conservatives believe in the ties that bind us, that society is stronger when we make vows to each other and we support each other. So I don't support gay marriage in spite of being a Conservative. I support gay marriage because I am a Conservative.
This archive hour is being broadcast on the same day as Pride in London, which is now one of the biggest in the world. But the actual 50th anniversary of Ted and Nettie and Stuart and all their friends and allies taking to the streets was yesterday. And that's when they retraced their original steps from Trafalgar Square to Hyde Park. They marched with Dan Glass of the newly reinvigorated Gay Liberation Front.
Since GLF began in 1970 and started Radical Gay Pride in 1972, and its politics are astoundingly insightful and rich when it comes to how we organise and change the world for the better, for everyone. And now, obviously, we've got the incredible historic moment of the 50th anniversary of the first Gay Pride demonstration on July the 1st. And that's why we're holding the demo. You are here because we were there, 50 years of Pride. Pride is both a carnival and a protest on the very same route that it happened 50 years back. And it's been such an honour to be part of it. It's been so informative and really emotional as well. You know, we've got activists speaking from Queer China, Make Poland Queer Again, Middle Eastern queer activists, all really paying tribute to the intersectional connections and the ongoing struggle for absolute freedom for all. But it's very different to July the 2nd, Pride in London parade. It's very different. You know, I'm in total support of all the people who go on Pride in London on the 2nd to be empowered and to feel part of community, but the politics are very different.
The story of Pride, from moment to movement, from London to the rest of the UK and around the world, and into diverse standalone events, is nothing short of inspiring. It's not perfect, inequality is not evenly experienced, and newly won rights are under attack again, at home and abroad. But it's a different world from the one that Nettie, Ted and Stuart were born into. And that's thanks to them, and thanks to Pride. Pride is a big part of the story being told in the UK's first dedicated LGBTQ+ museum. Queer Britain is just behind King's Cross Station in London and opened its doors to all earlier this year.
My name's Joseph Galliano. I'm the director and co-founder of Queer Britain, which is the first national LGBTQ+ museum.
My name is Dan Vo, and I'm also at Queer Britain, but I also like to call myself a queerator. So I have been looking at queer history across the sector for a little while in terms of museums and galleries. Well, Damien, I'm going to confess to you, my very first Pride March, I had prepared for it. I was working with a LGBTQ+ organisation at the time, and I had prepared for it. I'd done the banners for them, made it all ready to go, glittered up, and then I went to the group, I handed over the banners, and then I ran away. I just didn't quite have the courage to actually go through with it. Like, I was a mix of emotions. It was just, I really desperately wanted to, but then when I got there and had a look around, I just went, oh, is this for me? Can I really do this? Is this the place for me to be? And I think that's the thing. Like, I think when we're there, and I have since marched with a galleries, libraries, archives, museums group, that's a glam group, of course, where we've been a conglomerate of all sorts of different museums from across the country marching, and you're basically there with a bunch of nerds. And to have a place where I knew that I did belong there was so important and so affirming, and that's what led me to kind of do the first Pride here in London. And so I think that's what I always think of when we're doing things. You know, there's always going to be a scared kid that isn't sure about whether they do belong, but when they find the group around them who says, no, you do belong here, that's the important thing.
A large portion of the history of LGBTQ+ people has been one of erasure. Sometimes systematic, sometimes accidental, but it's been a big part of the problem. And it's why Pride was so important, why it was so important that people gathered together and were seen and were visible, and furthermore, that they're documented, they're archived, it's shown that their stories are important and that literally they have been seen.
As I stand in the museum and see people come through, I recognise that there's this like spark that just lights up in their eyes. They have been yearning to have their history marked, to be recognised. And I think that when you sort of look at Pride, that's what, in a blink of an eye as it marches past you, that's what's happening as well. People are yearning to be recognised and applauded just for being them.
One of the things that really highlights that point is that most days, at least one person will come in and burst into tears. And the reason that they burst into tears generally is one of joy at being seen. If we're still celebrating Pride in 50 years' time, I think what that could represent is the necessary vigilance that is needed to make sure that while rights can move in one direction, they can also move in another direction as well.
We've got centuries of history. You go right back to Celtic Britain and you'll find queerness there. You'll find us there. And there is so many centuries of history that shows us that sometimes the pendulum swings towards us, sometimes it goes away from us. And so there is a need to constantly be aware of what's going on, what's happening. There are so many rights to fight for right now. And I would love if in 50 years they were won. But then you kind of also ask, do we have full equality? Do we have equity as well? Have we covered for everybody? And I think so long as there still remains one person that we need to fight for, we should carry on.
I like them black gays. I like them white gays. I like them Asian gays. I like them mixed race gays.
Standing together, marching together, because of our differences, not in spite of them, we have achieved dramatic legal, social and cultural change. We've done a huge amount, but there's so much more to do. Yes, I can now get married and adopt if I want to. I can get a mortgage and complain about it. I can no longer be fired or evicted just for being gay. Two things that happened to me before the law was changed. But these benefits still aren't shared equally by every part of the community. And the law can go backwards as well as forwards. Roe v. Wade has just been overturned and equal marriage is next. We know it is. And if it can happen there, it can happen here, or it can happen anywhere. I don't take progress for granted, and neither should you. And that's one of the reasons why we still need pride. For so long as there are people who think that we should be ashamed of who we are, we will need pride. Pride is a beacon. It is a light. And in these increasingly dark times, we need pride now more than ever.
We didn't do it for people that weren't born then. We were doing it for ourselves. We were doing it for ourselves because we were so fucked up. That was the effect of all those laws and all those attitudes and all those actions by the police and the government and everybody else. It just made us neurotic.
It's so exciting to see what's happened since. And I think there's been a real change in the world. Almost all of it good for LGBT people.
I'm extremely proud of it. And I'm very glad to pass the torch on to anyone else who wants to help future lesbians, gays, trans people to stand up for themselves and achieve equality and circulate that equality and justice to the rest of the world.
And I'm not intending to stop fighting for liberation at all. I mean, I hope lots of younger people are going to be involved, but I'm not giving up.
Fifty Years of Pride was presented